Right.
So shall we start by introducing ourselves, that kind of thing?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
If you want.
Well, I'll start. Okay. I'm Yanni Menzies, the editorial director of Vertical.
And I'm Sardar Yegulov. I'm a contributor to Advanced Media Network, and I also produce my own site, theglind.com.
And I'm Aaron of the Ninja Consultant Podcast and PopCultureShock.com, and occasionally Publishers Weekly. Are you going to say something just in case
you're
talking this?
Sure. I'm Noah Fulmore, also of Ninja Consultant Podcast, and occasional contributor to Pop Culture Shock as well.
That's good enough. Occasional. So today we've come together to discuss the Gwyn Saga, which is a 120-volume and continuing epic fantasy series, and Vertical has just finished publishing the first 5 books. That's the March's episode of the Gwyn Saga. And this was actually long in the coming because we started putting out the hardcovers in 2003. It was actually one of the first 4 books we published, our debut works. You know, another one was Koji Suzuki's Ring. And we did 3 hardcover titles in the year 2003, but the sales weren't good, so we had to stop. And we realized that it was really a format issue then, rather than a content issue, because we'd originally done 2295 hardcovers. And also with covers that didn't really try to appeal to the manga reading audience or the Japanophilic audience. We just wanted to go for the straight fantasy audience. And we realized that mistake, so we started reissuing it in paperback in 2007, last year. First volume appeared in November, and just last month, in July 2008, we brought out the 5th book. And already, just for comparing the 3 paperback with the 3 hardcover, the hardcovers have been out for 5 years, but these have sold better, just in raw numbers. So it really was the right thing to do, to put it out in paperback form with the covers mostly transferred from the Japanese editions. Mm. And we have this, you know, $9.95 manga price point, but actually these are cheaper in Japan. The books are cheaper in Japan in general, and each volume costs only like 500 yen, $5. Plus, it has like a color spread, each volume. It's incredible. I don't know how they do it. we tried to have these in our English editions too.
Nice.
Yeah.
It was cost prohibitive, you know.
Oh, those are really nice.
You actually beat me to this issue because I was going to bring a couple of these myself and say, you know, why can't they be more like
520 yen, and they have a color insert. And of course, you know, the Gwyn Saga is a bestseller, and if you're selling more copies, you know, the unit cost goes down. But it wasn't a bestseller from the beginning, from, you know, book one, you know. At least not such a massive bestseller. And so I just got to conclude that Japanese printers print at lower prices.
Yeah, I was wondering if paper in Japan is just cheaper.
Well, the thing is, a lot of these printers feel it to be an honor when they're printing anything that's literary. Uh-huh. They want to make money. They make money from flyers. And with books, they're often willing to go at cost. You know, it's a prestige job, because most printed material isn't literary in any way. You know, so even if it's like entertainment fiction, I think maybe they give much lower quotes. Yeah.
Oh yeah, because my friends who have tried to like publish their own comics here, they find the printing cost really prohibitive.
That's always the most prohibitive part. Although things like print on demand, which is what I'm using for my own project, have made it a lot easier to do it without stumping for, you know, a huge initial outlay.
Mm-hmm.
It's still very difficult to get it under people's noses in some form, but at least that part isn't as difficult.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at, I was actually shopping in Book Off earlier today, and I was looking specifically for Japanese language Gwyn Saga volumes so that I could talk about the form factor as one of the things that distinguishes, you know, the Japanese publishing model from the American publishing model. You know, here we have this size book for $10 with slightly rougher paper. This is something that Stephen was talking about before, which I thought was a great idea. You know, that it really is pulp fiction.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And I said, you know, if we can do it this size, what's to stop us from doing something in that size? That, and then I realized if you tried to put that on a table in a Barnes & Noble, people would ignore it. They would think it was something somebody else had left there, like a leaflet or something. You know, like a Jack Chick tract, practically.
Oh, because it's too small?
Right. But
it'll get buried when it's spine out, you know?
Exactly.
When it's that small.
Oh, then it's very
thin. Because this is a standard paperback size. There's one standard paperback size that all Japanese publishing companies use. And that saves space for bookstores and for your own home, too. But, of course, that's not the case in the U.S. So if we try to do the standard Japanese size, it'll just be, you know, overlooked.
I noticed there were kind of wide margins in the line setting, and the American editions were sort of farther apart. And I'm like, oh, it seems like they've made this book appear much larger than it probably is. Like, kind of double spaced. But then I felt like I was reading really, really fast.
Well, that's part of the idea.
Yeah, that is.
They wanted to feel like it's a foot to the floor kind of thing. Actually, I was going to ask you how you wound up finding out about it and bringing it over here.
Well, I discovered it when I was in middle school because I was born and raised in Japan. And I was a middle school student. You know, I'd just discovered Tolkien a few years earlier and was really getting into fantasy and basically reading American fantasy. We had a lot of those in our school library. You know, David Eddings, Lloyd Alexander, that kind of stuff. And in fact, when I came to the Gwyn saga, I was actually skeptical. You know, I thought America, England, those are, you know, the places that produce the best fantasy series. So I came to it a doubter. But by the end of book 5, which is the March's episode, I was a total convert. And, you know, so when I turned 18, I came to the States and I sort of put aside the Gwyn saga because you couldn't find those books over here in the U.S. But I think I read up to like 35, 40. Yeah. That was 1990 when I came over.
I'm jealous already.
How often do new volumes come out there?
Well, very often, like three or four per year. And this isn't the only thing that she's writing, Kurimoto-san.
Oh,
it's
no.
Amazing. Yeah, this is the Gwyn saga is maybe only like a third of her total output.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What else does she write?
Well, she also has another series called Makai Suikoden. That's like the Suikoden is one of the Chinese classics,
oh, man.
The Tales of the Water Margin.
This.
It's the Tales of the Water Margin with a Cthulhu background, you know.
So, I'm sold already.
Yeah.
You've taken two of my fascinations right there.
That's 15.
Don't get this.
Yeah, that's 15 volumes, I believe. There are side stories to the Gwyn saga, and she actually is a very well-known and well-respected and awarded mystery writer.
Hmm.
And she has detective novel series. And but of course, Kurimoto-san being Kurimoto-san, she gives it interesting slants. Like sometimes there's a hermaphrodite character, you know, in an old Japanese family, you know, locked away in some room, you know, something like that tends to happen. And of course, Kurimoto Kaoru is a pseudonym, a pen name. She has another pseudonym, Azusa Nakajima, which is her name when she writes as a critic. She actually made her debut as a literary critic. You know, as Nakajima Azusa. And then this young, very young critic right out of school that was attracting a lot of attention from, you know, various quarters started writing the Gwyn saga as Kaoru Kurimoto. So she really is a success story. And she has been on, you know, television quiz shows, you know, long-running television quiz shows too. So she's something of a celebrity in Japan. Yeah, but she was on one of my favorite quiz shows. It was called Hinto de Pinto, and there were like five guys and five ladies, and you know there were separate teams and competing. She was the captain of the ladies team, and her name there was Nakajima Azusa. And it wasn't until I came to the States actually that I realized Nakajima Azusa and Kurimoto Kaoru were the same people. Both are pseudonyms. Yeah.
In my case, I'd actually heard about the Gwyn saga when I was doing research into science fiction and fantasy in Japan on my own. I'd actually gotten into Japanese pop culture through Japanese high culture. You know, I'd started with stuff like Kurosawa, and then my friend brings over this tape. Hey, is this movie Akira you gotta see? You know, and then it just spiraled from there.
Right,
and I started to find out about the popular literary scene in Japan, not just the stuff that they would write in, you know, the hopes of winning a Nobel Prize. And I started to get very curious about it because I was hearing about all these things which simply never showed up in English. And during a discussion of a very long-running science fiction series in German, Perry Rodan, which is like hundreds of books now, someone in the same context mentioned Gun Saga. And the name stuck in my head and sort of stayed there for a little bit, but didn't really touch anything else for a while. And then much later on, I bumped into... I actually bumped into an anthology book of fantasy cover art in Japan. And there was one with this... I think it was even one of these, believe it or not, one of volume one or two. I cannot remember for the life of me which one. And I was looking at it and going, what is this? And I had learned just enough Japanese at that point to sound out gooing. And I smacked my forehead and said, all right, I have to find out what this is. And again, I hit a wall. And then, again, like around 2003, when these started coming out in hardcover, I said, all right, this is obviously something that needs to be a mission. So... this is the funny part. I went and grabbed the first volume in hardcover, used. It was actually an ex-library edition, courtesy of Amazon. Don't kill me.
Oh, it's okay.
It was very hard to find at that point. And I got up to about halfway through it, and then I had to throw it in the trash.
Oh, no.
Because the second half of the book was the same as the first.
Oh. Yeah.
There was a printing run.
About 3% of them got misprinted. You know, there was one batch where that happened.
And I just... I would just... I couldn't stand it because I was just getting hooked. So I went back to Amazon, and this time I ordered all three of them. And I think even from the same guy. So they all arrived within a couple of days of each other. And I sat there and just blasted my way to the end of the volume of the third volume. And then I sat there and went, oh, no. I've run out again. And then I found out, oh, they're coming out in softcover, and they're going to have the illustrations. And then I get to the end of volume five. And again, I'm going, oh, they've got me so hooked.
Yeah. At least it's got... a kind of resolution.
Sort of, kind of.
Yeah, it reads the arc very well.
There's still so much stuff that is left open in it. And actually, if I can digress for a bit, this is one of the things I think that really sets it apart from a lot of the American-style fantasy, you know, the Western-style fantasy, you know, the Tolkien shadow stuff, as I call it. The form factor is important. You have a 300-page book, which ends on a cliffhanger. You have a cliffhanger, a cliffhanger, a cliffhanger, a cliffhanger, and then you have a sort of a resolution, but you still have a lot of stuff left up in the air. We still don't know where Gwyn really came from. We still don't know what a lot of the other things that have been dropped or hinted at in the background are really all about. So there's just enough of a resolution to make you feel satisfied for the time being, but you're still hungry. You still want to go back for more. And then with these other books that we get in, like Aragon, which has to be one of the worst things I've read in such a long time... it's just like everything is in one place, and that's it. And there's no mystery, there's no suspense, there's no urgency, there's no need for you to really feel like you have to keep reading. And the form factor, again, is part of that, because when you run a book, that's it. You got to wait.
Well, interesting thing is, you know, I do admire Aragon, and not just because, you know, the guy was a teenager.
Yeah, he's really young.
I mean, it is a successful novel that follows a certain sort of template, and that template is, you know, it always has to start in a sleepy town, you know, and there's some shady guys, and then protagonist gets involved and it has to run away, and then there are elves and dwarves. There have to be elves and dwarves for some reason.
That's exactly what I hated, is that
I'm impressed by the guy on one level, and I'm thinking, you're so young, and why do you have to follow these traditional forms? But the weird thing is the Gwyn Saga is following older, you know, older than Tolkien models.
It's,
you know,
the Hagrid model.
Yeah, exactly.
Marty Howard, exactly. I loved that stuff.
Clark Ashton Smith, you know, Henry Kuttner, and of course, you know, Howard Lovecraft too, but because he did some, you know, of the stories too. But so this Japanese woman is harking back to a Native American tradition of fantasy, whereas all these very talented American fantasy writers, you know, are the best-selling ones, like Jordan's Wheel of Time, same has to start in a sleepy village, you know.
Right.
And they're following the British model set up by Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, and they've forgotten the, you know, American roots of fantasy, which, right. you know, Kurimoto shows with this series that there's a lot there that you can build on.
You pretty much took the words out of my mouth for that whole thing, because I kept thinking, you know, for her, for everyone over there, as it were, the whole European mode, the whole Howard mode, you know, the whole Sumerian mode, I guess you could call it, it's alien to them.
Mm-hmm.
American fantasy prose is concerned that the people who come back to that expect the same narrative again and again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a phatic experience where just being able to go through the sleepy town that turns into a quest
right.
fulfills a prophecy, reminds you of what it was like the first time you picked up Tolkien. And I wonder to what extent, because I'm now fairly familiar, not in through fantasy novels in Japan, but through animation primarily, that there are set formula, certainly. To what extent does Japanese fantasy have that sort of set formula?
Well, in terms of, we can tell from the games that they do have that whole derivative. You know, if you, I think you've played Japanese fantasy games where it's just as Tolkien oriented or Tolkien derivative.
They definitely have their own template.
And but the, well, I mean, fantasy for Japanese people, I mean, it is a Western thing, and it's borrowed swords. Of course, they have variations where it's samurai instead of, you know, swords. But even with Final Fantasy, like, they have the monk character, ninja character. That's actually derivative of wizardry. It's because wizardry had those that, you know, they have those. And but one thing that can be said about the Gwyn Saga is that it was serialized originally in SF magazine, SF magazine, and that was actually kind of vanguardist magazine where each issue would have translations of new American science fiction, and it was first serialized there in four portions, and was supposed to be just, you know, book one as we know it now, but it was so immensely popular that they started it as a book series. And the editor in chief then of the SF magazine was Mr. Imaoka, who's who later married Kurimoto-san, and yes, and I've actually never met Kurimoto-san, but I've met Imaoka-san, who's not only her husband but her agent. Yeah, and what's amazing about Kurimoto-san is all this time she's been a housewife too, you know, doing the dishes, cooking, you know, cleaning, everything.
Have kids?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't think so, but I'm not exactly sure.
Is that the one that Ed was telling us about then? He's like, she thinks of new plots while she's vacuuming.
No. Exactly. You know, she's like bursting, by the time she sits down. It's only like 3 hours per day, but by the time she sits down, there are voices in her head and stories just
envious.
Waiting to unfold.
It's actually really wonderfully disciplined way to go, because, I mean, I know people come to me for writing advice all the time, and they say, well, you know, I have no ideas, I don't know what to write about. And I said, well, what happened last week? And they'll talk for 2 hours. And then I said, you know, well, what about all that? Oh, that's not very interesting. So, you know, already they have this built-in wall, you know, as far as what's interesting, what's not interesting, they don't know what to do. But if you're in the mode to think of everything as being inherently interesting, then yes, even if you only have 3 hours during the day to sit down and get that down, and she's probably still doing all this stuff longhand.
Yeah.
I would have gathered.
I don't know right now, but, well, for the longest time. And I know that because, you know, in Japan they have these manuscript papers, right?
Like a grid.
Set number of characters. And these are, like, the same number of manuscript pages every time. That, you know, I heard that once. So that must mean longhand. Maybe right now, you know, she's transitioned to word processing.
But I thought that the, especially in the first, well, no, in all of the books, like, the serialization in a magazine, like, you can kind of tell where the breaks are, where, like, there are breaks in the story.
The thing is, but the serialization was just this one,
just
though.
The first one.
Yeah, but that format was retained.
But they keep following the format.
It's almost as though she's deliberately trying to recreate that 20s pulp feel, you know?
And that's a good thing, because it keeps us involved, it keeps us... one of the things that I was talking about with a friend just the other day about Japanese popular culture in general is that they have this wonderfully keen sense of how to connect with a reader's heart or a watcher's heart or you know, whatever, the audience, and just draw you along so that the first thing that you're presented with is not necessarily a plot, but an emotional commitment. American stories are about plots. American stories are about, oh, who got killed in this locked room? A Japanese story is more about, what am I going to do? You know, it's more emotional. And for that reason, you're hooked far earlier in a story like this than I ever was in something like Wheel of Time, where halfway through I was flipping back trying to remember who everybody was.
Yes.
Because it was so damn boring.
But then the question is, you know, I mean, that those things sell very well. Hmm. So it is satisfying a lot of people.
It's a question of who's looking for what. I mean, there are a lot of people who want to, they want to have the Wheel of Time thing where they're basically immersed in a whole world that has its own logic. And then there are people who want to have an emotional experience, want to have an emotional connection and get the world building stuff as a nice, you know, bonus.
Maybe it's also like where you live, you know. Maybe if you live in South Dakota, I don't mean anything ill, but you know, maybe a sleepy opening is what grabs your attention.
My best friend from Iowa, who just moved to Seattle, the one I was talking about this, he was visiting me just this past week, and he basically was reading everything in my library before he had to go back home, and he read all of these in the space of about 4 hours. Mm. And every time he finished one, he would come back down to my office, put it back on the shelf, shake his fist at me, and say, I hate you so much, and he would grab the next one and go back upstairs. And I had to bite my lip to keep from laughing so hard because he was doing that all day.
Well, that's a good reaction. Now, you say that the numbers are good for American fantasy.
Well, yeah.
Is that really the case now?
Compared to, let's say, sci-fi, you do see fantasy books on bestseller lists. You don't see sci-fi books anymore unless they're Star Wars novelizations. But it used to be the case that, like, in the 70s, for example, Clark would write Rendezvous with Rama or whatever, and they were bestsellers. But sci-fi, serious sci-fi, no longer has that mass market, whereas the Jordan-esque fantasy genre still does, you know, sell a very large number of copies. And we were trying to tap into that with our hardcover formatting.
Right.
But we switched to the kind of light novel, you know, presentation.
We have a friend who reads a lot of science fiction and fantasy books, and she no longer buys hardcovers. She's always going for like the mass market paperback. I don't know if it's a budget issue or just like, I think it's also a personal preference, so she can carry it on the subway.
Well, I know that hardbacks tend to be a very prestige kind of thing, that a lot of publishers, whenever there's an A-list author and they're getting like a 500,000 copy print run for a new book, it's always got to come out in hardcover because then they can give it placement in the store, and then they can, you know, put it front and center, and it looks important on somebody's shelf. There really is a lot of marketing in this that people don't
review attention to it.
Right.
Not so much anymore, but it used to be the case that only hardcovers really got, you know, a reviewer's writing.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yes.
And, I mean, things are starting to change because it's getting really expensive to produce stuff. Frankly, I don't care what the form factor is. I love this even more than the hardcovers, in fact. If somebody was bringing out stuff again in that tiny Japanese form factor, I'd snap it right up. But I know that it's not a viable option in the U.S.
The thing is, in Japan, too, usually books come out in hardcover first and then in paperback. But what they did with the Gwyn Saga is that, you know, this is the original format, this small paperback. The, you know, term light novel didn't exist when the Gwyn Saga first came out, but it really is the mother of light novels. This and Vampire Hunter D, which started coming out the next year.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what is the light novel? They come out in paperback, that's one thing. And they have illustrations, they're serialized, and there's usually some kind of supernatural thing going on, even if it's set in school, someone has ESP or something like that.
Yeah.
And
so light novel implies genre.
You don't get
just regular prose light novels.
They usually have illustrations. Game. Yeah, they usually have, like not realism.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just, a Dark Horse, I think. No, Del Rey, I'm sorry. They just sent me some newer translations of stuff. There's a fellow in Japan, Nishi Oishin is his pen name, and he's like a one-man industry, the same way Kurumoto-san is. And they're starting to bring his stuff over in English. Mm-hmm. Viz picked up the Death Note novel that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right.
And I went through that, and I went through the other one that I did, Zaragoto, which is one Del Rey brought out. And they're really fun. They're really zippy. Mm. And that's, I think, that's the way that they're designed to be. They're designed to be a fast read, but they're not designed to leave you feeling empty. They're designed to leave you feeling like you've had some kind of an emotional experience. That way they're a lot more satisfying than just, you know, an ordinary, a more mechanical story. Mm.
And they tend to be feats of the imagination. You're always impressed by the author's imagination with light novels. That's, you know, it's usually there's something fancy going on, some kind of acrobatics in terms of thematics or plot.
And I think it is likely that a real niche can be established in the U.S. market.
I think it already has happened.
That's what, Vertical's trying that, but other larger publishers with more money and force.
Well, and I don't know if you want to reveal this or not. So you have the 5 books, that's one arc. What kind of numbers would you need in order to, in terms of readership, in order to be convinced to put out the second 5?
Well,
what have you?
I would say, well, it's hard because, of course, 2 sells less than 1 and 3 less than 2. And at one point it starts stabilizing. But if we can be sure that we're going to sell 3,000 of each, that's the minimum. That it won't go under that, you know, even if we continue.
And at some point, if you
but hopefully 5,000.
Yeah. And at some point, if you start establishing enough of a base, it'll start to ramp back up.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, this property has attracted Hollywood's attention from the beginning. I can't name names, but in 2004, there was a major well-known production company that came to us. We even got to the stage of their providing a treatment to us. And unfortunately, I had to say no and veto the project because they were changing the story way too much. Like, in the middle of the story arc, Rinda kisses Gwyn's mask, and the mask melts away.
Oh, and thumbs down.
Because they felt that,
you know. You can't pull the gaff that early.
Because, you know, the idea is that no major actor is going to attach himself to the project if his face isn't going to show.
Which is nonsense.
But there are other ways to, like, for example, I think you're familiar with 300, the Spartans movie. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any famous actor in there, but it did so well. Just the style of that thing, I think, is reminiscent of...
If I may. On page 224 of the third book, that illustration there, I said to my friends, all you have to do is put this on the poster. People will rip the hinges off the doors of the theater to go see it.
It is quite good.
Well, I certainly hope that would be the case.
People but respond to an image.
There was an anime series announced recently.
Yeah.
How long did you know about
Aniplex.
That?
Well, Aniplex before? Is going to do a TV anime pretty soon. The thing is, Kurimoto-san has been approached by many, many parties for a long time.
Yeah.
And she always said no, especially to movie deals, because only Hollywood can pull it off in terms of budget, you know, something like this. And, of course, the actors have got to be Western here, Caucasian, you know.
Yes.
Of course, they could cast African-American as Istvan or something, but basically it has to be Caucasian. And anime, she felt that, you know, it had to be really a live-action, huge Hollywood-type thing for there to be justice to this. But, you know, because the whole Japanese anime thing is taking off, she has, you know, finally said yes. And also because she's gone beyond, you know, book 100 now. And
there's plenty of material.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, that's their métier over there. This is something, that's a medium that they can do so well and do so much with so expressively. Mm. Let me put it this way. My desire to see a movie made from this material is bigger than any ego that I could have about it. The mere fact that it would be on screens would be enough of a thrill.
And we'll be able to, if that happens, I can guarantee that we'll be doing more books.
Well, if the anime is brought into the U.S., then you have all these huge
alone.
Tie-in opportunities.
No, I think even with the anime airing in Japan, it should move more copies in that case.
And what's interesting is, after, I'm not going to give anything major away, but the first 5 story books are the Marches episode set in the no man's land of Nosferus. From 6 to 10, we suddenly go to Paros. Paros, the crystal, the most civilized city in the middle country. And we, you know, it's like Paris, suddenly, after the Sahara Desert. And she handles that as well as, you know, all the desert action. The urban intrigue, you know, political intrigue. It's called the intrigues episode. That's when I really, really started respecting Kurimoto-san, actually, because this is great, but to be able to do that too with the, within the same story was just so impressive for me.
This is actually something that I see in a great deal of entertainments out of Japan and Asia generally, Korea also, I've noticed a lot of this, where you will have a lot of different moods or conceits all wrapped up in under the same rubric, and the material at its best will shift gears between all of them very, very fluidly. You'll have comedy in one moment, you'll have really serious drama in the next moment, and then you'll have some really horrific thing happening, and it's all part of a continuum. It doesn't feel like a bunch of stuff colliding. And again, I think it's because once they have your heart, anything is possible.
Right.
You're going to follow them through to the end. So all this stuff feels like it's all part of a, all part of a piece.
Right. And what's interesting is, on the one hand, the Gwyn Saga feels very, very original. And on the other hand, it's like the most eclectic series ever. Like the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, the Chinese epic, that's totally reflected here. Gora, Chaeronea, and Paros. And of course, there's that 20s pulp. This is almost a cannibalistic series that, you know, and Kurimoto-san was very conscious about this. She said, you know, I'm going to write the super novel that's going to have the good elements of everything that's been written in terms of adventure fiction. If you start looking, it's actually a fascinating exercise. I wonder if you're familiar with Walter Scott, you know?
Certainly.
Yeah, the Waverly is considered the first historical novel, early 19th century. And there's a scene from that that's pretty much the template for something that happens in book 4 with Count Marus being betrayed. Yeah. And he glares at Istvan, and Istvan can't forget it. Istvan doesn't forget that for many books.
Yeah, that actually...
An almost identical thing occurs in Waverly, the first historical novel. And there are tons of stuff like that. You can play all these intellectual games. In a way, it's a very postmodern work. This work was written by a critic who made her debut in the late 70s when it was, you know, postmodernism was all the rage. And she went out and said, okay, I'm going to create a pure entertainment work that's just going to steal from everybody, you know. You know, she succeeded. That's what's amazing. Not all critics say, okay, I'm going to write the novel that I've been telling everyone should write and actually succeed. Mm. Yeah.
Actually, that was something that you had mentioned a while back when you were doing one of the panels, I think at NYAF last year. Mm. And I thought, that is exactly what needs to happen. I think it was Francois Truffaut who said this, because he was himself a film critic. He said, the best way to criticize any one movie is to make another movie.
Mm.
And that was pretty much what he would do, is that he would go out and make a movie as a response to something else that he felt had not been done well or the way that he wanted to do it. I thought that was probably the best way to look at it, and it also means that criticism is more than just pointing at something and going, this stinks. Okay, people like this. Clearly there's something here that's good. Let's break that down. And then when you get into the habit of learning how to do that, you get into the habit of learning how to take what you find and put those in your own work.
Did she, as it was being ported into the U.S., was she tempted to make any changes, do you know?
No.
How involved was she in that process?
She has been very, very good to us from the beginning. Very placed a lot of trust in us. No, she didn't ask to make any changes. You know, she was pleased that we were publishing it in English. I mean, the manga boom was beginning to take off when we spoke to her. That was 2001. But you know, with novels, it was far from what we kind of assume now. Any Japanese author would have been flattered at the point if someone wanted to translate their stuff. And in that sense, I was kind of shocked that this thing hadn't been translated. Same with many other authors, you know? And that's why we found it Vertical. But, yes.
I would assume that any publisher in the U.S. would look at it and be like, oh, it's 120 volumes long. Like, that's kind of a big commitment.
Yeah.
Well, you look at it the other way. It's a money machine. You know, right. To get people hooked on it.
Exactly.
Potentially. But it's also a huge gamble. And
yeah, we had both considerations. And we were glad that the first five stories were a story arc. So we got a written contract for the first five books and a verbal oral agreement for the first 16. Because that's kind of a story arc. Of course, we told our investors, if this thing takes off, then we can IPO on the basis of this alone, you know, go public.
Yeah.
Because yeah. Nice. It's 120. Yeah. Well, at that point, it was 87 or 8 books.
So what were some of the challenges in the actual translation, like, specific to this book?
Well, we were lucky in that we found a great translator in Alexander O. Smith. At that point, he hadn't translated any prose. He'd done just games, basically. Mm-hmm. This was his first prose work. It's actually a point of pride for me and for Vertical that we brought Smith into the world of, you know, translating books. The thing is, he loves the fantasy genre, and he's read a lot of fantasy fiction. I think maybe he's been trying to write his own too. So he already had this fantasy style. And also, I mean, you know, not that I'm saying degrees matter, but he did go to Harvard and such places. So he's a solid writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this we got lucky in that sense by finding Smith.
I guess I once saw.
One reviewer who reviewed the hardcover volume one when it came out, I think SF Reader, someone at SF Reader, said, "This is the best translation from Japanese I've ever read."
Oh, wow.
You know, including Kawabata and all that. And I do believe it is that good. And what's interesting is that when you read the Gwyn Saga in the Japanese, it feels almost purplish. Mm-hmm. She's writing in a Baroque style on purpose. When you translate it into English, that aspect is less salient. Mm-hmm. Think of like Haruki Murakami, writing that feels regular for Japanese readers when it's translated into English might feel vague or almost bland. This has a sense of, you know, flesh that, again, it's because she was harking back to that American model and very consciously producing something that would feel foreign and almost American. Yeah. Pulpy for Japanese readers.
I have read a number of criticisms of some Vertical's titles. Like, for instance, on Amazon, where people say the translation is terrible, just it's so flat. And I would say to myself, no, that's because that's the way it was written.
It's a good translation.
Yeah, they're being faithful to the fact that it's very spare prose and that it's not meant to be very, like you said, very purplish.
Mm.
What I liked most about the translation was the fact that I never at one point felt like I was reading one. Mm. I was just reading a great book. And I was not sitting there with a middling translation. I often sit there and feel myself second guessing. I say to myself, okay, well, what were they really trying to say? I do know some Japanese. I'm by no means a translator.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you started reading Gwyn Saga in Japanese?
I would love to. I'm not very good. I mean, I know, to quote somebody else, I know just enough to get into trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, I can smell a bad translation when I see one. And when I was reading this, I was just shaking my head and saying to myself, you know, I could force this on anybody with the name removed and they would never know. And
exactly.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
I think especially it's after maybe the first half of the first book. It really picks up till by the fifth book. It really seemed not at all.
Something else that came to mind when I was reading this is, and this is something that I am starting to see ramp up a little bit. A lot of Japanese creative properties that are not specifically, there's nothing inherently Japanese about them, except for the fact that they were created there. More recently, we had the series Claymore, which I love, or Berserk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're all influenced by
Vampire Hunter D itself. You know, I'm also a fan of that. And while there are touches of, you know, things in there that are you know, Asian or what have you, if the name was filed off, you'd probably never know the difference. And I said, you know, if Hollywood is going to start anywhere, they should start with stuff like this because it's so easy to transport without losing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's already alien to its original audience. It'll be just fine to us too. And that was again why I was saying if there's a short list of properties, this should go right at the top.
It is towards the top. You know, you gotta give credit to Hollywood because just in our first maybe 18 months of operations, so many production companies, you know, contacted us, including, you know, one set up by actors, you know, like Brad Pitt. Those guys have their, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, almost all of them.
I had a friend of mine from college worked at Leonardo.
So they are watching. They are watching. They have people who are studious and curious enough to find a little company like Vertical.
It's the idea of buying arm of Hollywood. Even if they're not really making a production, they read newspaper stories and they're like, we'll buy so-and-so.
And they're always looking for something fresh and new. And the problem is that they have to now go outside of house to do it. I'm going to digress for a second about Hollywood here again. When Hollywood was young, everybody who worked there came in from the outside.
Yeah.
You had people who came in from the army. You had people who came in from all walks of life. You had people who came in just looking for any job.
Yeah.
There was no film school. The film school was the studio.
Yeah.
You went there and learned side by side with everybody. And then bit by bit it started to get very formalized. And I think that really started to make things, it started to become very difficult to take any chances. And I know that, you know, there was a lot of stuff produced in the golden age of Hollywood that, you know, today would be seen as totally doctrinaire. But at the same time, there was a sense that if you had the personality and the vigor to make something happen, you could do it. And now it's all about focus groups and numbers. And because the audience is not the customer anymore.
Yeah.
Supply chain is the customer. They're looking for what they can sell to a supply chain, not to people in seats.
Yeah, I heard someone had a really interesting quote recently that said that was something like, television is about the numbers and movies is about names or something like that, which I really struck home working television.
But it's precisely why there is a chunk of audience that is not being served and that smaller companies that are more nimble, like Vertical, can potentially address that.
That's why I love these guys.
Yeah.
Well, I might be digressing maybe a little too much, but that's what's great about the Nintendo DS. You know, they have lower specs, so all these little companies can try their own thing. You know, if it's a huge game, you know, that takes as much manpower and, you know, time and money as a Hollywood movie, so it's going to be following a certain template, whereas Nintendo DS has allowed companies to have very short, like maybe a half year development, you know, span, and they put things out like classic type RPG, you know, Atlus. Yes, I think maybe if that starts happening with movies, we'll be starting to see, you know, a greater variety of films. Like, neither like huge budget nor like completely independent, but, you know, under 20 million.
Yeah, a comfortable middle.
Mm.
And I mean, like, that's what they used to do. There used to be a whole line, you know, a whole production line in Hollywood for movies that were in a, you know, relatively controlled budget that would make a decent amount of money. And then they just started to progressively forget about that and try to figure out how to make everything into a blockbuster. Problem is, not everything is going to be a blockbuster. You know, they are coming back to sanity gradually, but there's been a lot of damage done by that kind of thinking, and it's made it very difficult. It's made it very difficult for them to really be open to new possibilities and to assume that, you know, their audience may be a lot more curious than they originally believed. One of the other things that I was thinking about when I was reading the Goon series, this is a little hard to put into words because it's very personal. It's another one of the reasons that I was so enamored of it. We have a hero in this story who is faced with all of these different external tasks. You know, he has to pull armies together out of nothing, which I love. But the whole thing is really about the most fundamental human question of all, which is, who am I? What am I? Am I human or not human, even? You know, at the end, he finally realizes that he now has permission to say, yes, I am a man.
Yeah.
Because I've been standing by these two kids whose worst crime was that they were born into the wrong family. You know, that kind of thing. And then I saw the series really start to develop, especially in book four. Book four is very introspective. And there was this whole beautiful segment in the middle of it. A lot of people thought it was slow. I didn't think it was slow.
No, that was the best part.
And where he's really digging down in himself and making these remarkable discoveries about who he really is or really ought to be. And I said, you know, this is really not what I've expected at all from this series. Or, again, in the same book, we have Istvan's betrayal, which really hit me very, very deeply. And I said, okay, now I understand how big the ambitions for this series really are. She's not just trying to give us a thrill ride. Yeah. She's trying to give us everything.
Because that event is, like, relevant in book 90-something.
Yeah, it's hugely pivotal. I could tell it was hugely pivotal just because you had Istvan, who was, whole time he's been this real, you know, he's basically been a roustabout and a rake hell, and, you know, he thinks he can get away with anything, and then he discovers there are certain things you cannot get away with because you'll always know.
Yeah. He's haunted by it over and over.
Right. Yeah. I love that.
He's really, he really...
By the way, Koji Suzuki's favorite is book 4. You know, he started reading it upon my recommendation, and what he liked about it is he likes stories where, you know, a man is alone and he has to fight against nature and try to survive. So there's that whole chase sequence with the wolves, you know.
Yeah. That's like what the
I finally just finished reading Promenade of the Gods myself, and there is a certain element of that, because it starts off very much in a detective story vein. And even there, it's not pitched like a traditional detective story. He's trying to fit together what look like facts out of what seemed to be total chaos. And so it basically is a kind of man against nature. Mm-hmm. The nature that he's against is the nature of his fellow man.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And also, I think the Gwyn saga, especially the whole saga, but even just reading the first five, it serves as a kind of leadership manual, I think, because Gwyn is such a powerful figure. Instead of reading all those leadership books that you can find in bookstores, like, if you're interested in leadership, don't read Giuliani's book. You know, read the first five books of the Gwyn saga.
He steps up and puts together an army out of literally nothing. He goes to these very little monkey creatures in the middle of the wasteland who have nothing. He says, okay, what do you have? And then he finds out, you've got what we need. Exactly what we need.
Yeah, plenty of resources.
It does help when you're the ubermensch. You know, the gods are on your side.
And he has this built-in pulling
the threads of fate.
He's not a jerk about it. You feel for the guy because he does have an understanding of just how big a weight he's carrying around, and he tries to have some sense of humor about it. He tries to look at it in the bigger picture. I loved it in the first book when the two twins are whining about being split up, and he just says, "Get used to it." It's like, if this is the worst thing you can think of, you're in for some bad trouble.
And I love those sentences about, like, fate and destiny.
Right.
You know, that's sort of the philosophical core of it. Yeah, too. Yeah.
But, the whole thing is really woven around the whole idea of, there are people who can serve as a nexus for the way things change. They can embody these things without even trying. They're sort of like magnets. They're people flock to them without quite realizing why. And then when they finally realize why, they can use that as a fulcrum to make things happen. You know, you have one woman who refused to give up her seat on the bus. Look what came of that.
Sure.
On an incredible revolution in social justice.
So I want to ask, what besides hosting roundtable discussions and so forth, how are you really promoting the series? Mm.
Well, we did many more ads for this than for our, regular title. We also made Gwyn masks.
Oh yeah, I think we have one, seen actually, or maybe
did we pick one up?
Yeah, at some point, at some con, I'm sure.
So when you say ads, these are ads that are going in manga. They're going in
advertisement and various monthly fanzines and such. The usual suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, print.
Well, on my end, I know that I've been stumping as hard as I can for it through word of mouth. I found that
the best form of advertising.
Exactly.
Yes.
A friend of mine who runs an internet radio station that focuses on anime music and game music has said, word of mouth is the only thing I have ever found in the years that I've been running this thing that get people to come back. Flyers do not work. Ads do not work. Cross promotions don't work. The only thing that works is having people talk to other people. And so on my own site, I looked at the first three hardcover books, and I was heartbroken at the end of that. And then these come out, and I do those for AMN.
Yeah.
And they were actually kind of surprised, and they said, well, what's the tie-in? And I told them about the whole, the whole spiel, and they said, wow. Keep in touch with these guys. And I said, oh, yeah, well, they're going to be sending me the Tezuka stuff, too. So I have a good reason to get on their good side.
Yeah, and definitely from the beginning, when we came out with the hardcovers in 2003, and from earlier when we contacted Kurimoto-san through Imaoka-san, movies, you know, visual adaptation has been a part of our strategy. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting for that to happen, and finally, it will happen. That TV anime series is pretty much guaranteed, and something's gonna come about, I think, through Hollywood.
I first heard of the Gwen Saga as legendary, like, I think in the terms of a conversation about really long-running series, and, like, what's Same the here. Longest manga-running yeah. series of all time, and then people were like, well, what about that fantasy series with the guy with the leopard head that's over 100 books long? So are you current on the Japanese series, like, reading it?
Well, I'm not up to 120.
Oh, what are you up to?
No, I'm not that far along, but I actually, it broke my heart, but I've had to read synopses of, Yeah, because I'm talking to Hollywood and, you know, I need to be the guy who knows everything, right?
It's like reading Soap Opera Digest or something. Yeah, that's
but, so, I'm bursting with all this information. I won't, spoil anything for you.
No. If you do that, I will find you.
But, I mean, sorry, he still doesn't know where he came from.
I cannot answer that question.
Okay.
Can neither confirm nor deny.
I mean, I want this to be identity. Something we can discover on our own, because that's part of the pleasure of it.
Because my friend who reads who collects a lot of fantasy stuff, she won't read Wheel of Time she won't read a series till it's complete because she reads very fast. And so Gwen Saga is sort of it's not over yet, so she would not be in. Actually,
you have to pitch it differently. So, yeah. The first thing you have to understand is that it will never be over.
Yeah, but it won't.
Well, it'll. But for Wheel of Time, my friend. Wheel of Time is over. Eventually, it will be over.
Yeah.
She's also disappointed if the author dies eventually. Before they finish writing it.
Yeah.
That doesn't work either.
That's true. But she's still quite. I mean, she's no longer as young as she was when she started writing, but she's still doing it on the same schedule.
Have to go to the hospital for cancer last year.
Oh,
and she has been able to leave, and it's in the remission stage, but she's mortal.
When she has an ending planned secretly.
She already knows what the last sentence is going to be. She said that from the beginning.
It's sort of, again, I keep making comparisons to Berserk. And again, Kentaro Miura is a Gwen Saga fan.
Yes.
He
rhymes as they come out regularly. Yeah. And he's exactly the same way. He knows exactly how the whole thing is going to work. He has it all in his head. It's just going to take him a certain amount of time to go through it and delineate each particular point. And I've been reading that one every bit as hungrily as it's been coming out in English.
I believe he's gone so far as to say, if there was no Gwyn, there would be no Berserk.
Mm-hmm. He did, yeah.
Yeah.
He pretty much said that.
And a lot of famous people have been reading the Gwyn Saga regularly. We had Nagisa Oshima.
That stunned me.
Isn't that? And a lot of other people, editors, who are vice presidential level at their companies. Like, I know one gentleman in his 50s at Kodansha, and he's been reading every book, of the Gwen Saga.
So we went to Comiket, the big comic market in 2006. Well, it's important to have goals.
I haven't been to Japan yet. I have to get over there one of these years. It's just a matter of money, that's all. But go ahead. Yeah.
But one thing I was impressed with that I wasn't really expecting was the tremendous amount of fan produced novels. I kind of went just for comics, but almost half, not half, maybe a little a third of the rooms that we went to had all these lovely fan novels, and I was confident I could learn enough Japanese to read maybe the doujinshi that I bought, but not enough Japanese to anytime soon finish any of the fan works. So there's so many characters in every book, it seems rife for ridiculous amounts of fan works.
Is this fan fiction you're talking about? Not
Fan material, fiction, self-published fan fiction in novel form.
Right.
Some of which was some of which had great covers. There was a tremendous amount of Rose of Versailles tables where I would pick it up being like, oh wow, Rose of Versailles, like, and I'm hoping it was a comic and it would be novels. Yeah. It was all novels.
It's like hitting a wall.
And then and the Japanese people would ask me like, oh, do you read Japanese? And I'd be like, oh, little, not enough.
No, like, and we'd shake our heads sadly and like, put it back. Down.
Yeah. Mm. That's interesting because I don't, at least I'm not aware of fanfic versions of the Gwen saga, but what's often said about this series that it turns into like fanfic.
It has its own fanfic building.
It has its fanfic elements, and many Japanese readers have criticized Kurimoto for it. You know, fanfic is like you take this character, this other male character, and they go off and have sex, right? And that happens in the series itself.
There's no need to write anything.
Oh my.
Wow. Then she's clearly trying to push everyone out of the market.
When you have that many
balls to yourself.
Without giving too much away, Amnelis, the icy lady, happens to her. Yeah. Doesn't happen to Gwen yet, though.
You're definitely revealing too much.
Okay. I did notice something in book 5 where one of the soldiers, it was like, he was more interested in protecting this other guy. And I'm like, whoa.
Well, you know, armies, that kind of thing.
But that doesn't happen until much later. Much later.
There was something that you'd mentioned a couple of seconds ago that I was going to follow up on about the fanfic thing. One of the things that I've definitely noticed is that even if there people are not, you know, explicitly imitating it, they're certainly taking inspiration from it in all of these different directions. One of my favorite bands is Killing Joke. And when they first got together, they said, okay, we're in a band. What do we want to do with it? What do we really want to do with it? Then get up on stage and play music. And they said that one of the biggest things they wanted to do was serve as a kind of a creative inspiration, like a source of energy, so that you would listen to the record and then you would say, I want to take that energy, I want to funnel it into something in my own life. I don't want to just sit there and listen to records. And they basically want to be the inspiration for other people's bands, you know.
Wow.
But even just in the most basic way, but you know, for anything really. And I thought a lot of the same flavors here. You read this. First thing I wanted to do when I was done with it was go out and write a book. And I have already. It's been, you know, go out and write another
like,
one.
And I did.
and for my money, it's exactly that fantasy does best.
Mm.
Where every fantasy text, essentially, you open it up, you turn the page, and there's a map.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there are all yeah. kinds of crazy mm-hmm. names. Mm-hmm. And usually the first book doesn't cover but maybe a handful of those mm-hmm. places. Mm-hmm. And so it creates mm-hmm. a sort of openness to the world mm-hmm. where you know there's so much out there and then whatever is beyond the map. And it's certainly true that there's a great deal of patterning in fantasy literature, but I think it's all based around that kernel of
true.
Openness.
Yes. Yes.
Anything can happen within certain disciplinary limits.
Yeah. What I like in the maps in Gwyn Saga is like they kind of expand. Like I
right.
think
in the first one, it's very limited.
And only
of course the map. There was no map in the first books of the Gwyn Saga in Japanese.
Ah.
Yeah. Because it wasn't...
Yeah, and that's just like...
It's just a little corner of it.
The
you've
corner,
got the whole
and
desert.
Then the next one...
Which gives you a great idea of, you know, the dimensions
and
of everything.
In book 5, you got the world map.
Yeah. It's like we're zooming out. Like,
and also you get that epilogue where, you know, you... you know, you learn what happens to some of the major characters, you know, what they become.
I'm like, things go well for me.
And what's interesting is that thing we have as an epilogue...
Yeah.
In the original Japanese version, it was at the beginning of book 3. And Alex Smith and I talked about it and said, let's put it at the end of book 5.
Did you have to consult them before you did that kind of editing? Because
I
know a lot of them are very finicky. I'm remembering what happened with Kino's Journey.
Mm.
The author of that was really not happy with the way the book was basically
and got canceled, right?
Resegmented. Yeah,
no, but we did get approval. It's interesting because, you know, we thought most American readers don't expect that kind of spoiler to occur right in the middle of a cliffhanger, actually. But even at the end of book 5, maybe, you know, it feels strange for people used to, you know, regular narratives for some of that ending to be given away.
But yeah, I think
it's
a good
beautiful,
decision.
It's
not so much
future.
The ending, but the state of things around volume 60. You know, that's what's given away at the end of book 5.
And there's often an element of prophecy in fantasy literature.
Yeah, yeah, that's
so you already, although sometimes it's a question of exactly how the prophecy is going to manifest itself, typically you know.
Right.
It's the supernatural version of foreshadowing. You know, and typically some of the fun is that things simply don't manifest the way that you might have expected, or there's some kind of twist on it.
Right. It goes where you think, but not how you expect it.
Yeah, I'm really glad there's like a lack of prophecy, because like that gets really old. You're the legendary so-and-so who's come to save us. Like, I'm glad that's not in there. Everyone's just like, what the heck?
And you know, like, you remember that guy Orof Taurus in book one? He helps Gwyn by lending him his sword. You know, you meet his parents. You know, his parents run an inn in Taurus, and they become major characters. They become some of the major lower class, you know, lower middle class characters.
Yeah. See, stuff like that I love, because it really gives you a sense of the world being a continuum and not simply just, you know, stuff getting tossed out and tossed out. I guess part of the allergy that I've had to a lot of Western style fantasy as it's been written lately is because there is so much emphasis on world building that there is very little emphasis on character building, or rather, you have one completely trumping the other. And when I was struggling through the first Wheel of Time book, and finally I got to the end of it, and a week later, my friend asked me what I thought of it, and I said, I can't remember a damn thing that happened.
I feel the same way.
And then he got all the way to the end of like book 12 or whatever it was at the end, and I said, so what happened? And he just gave me this glazed look. And I said, that's the problem, because there's nobody that you care about, right? And it's like, well, you know, there's this character and that character. And he said, no, but, you know, was there ever a sense when you were turning the page that you could burst into tears? And he shook his head. And I said, there you go. Your heart is not being grabbed.
With the heart grabbing and, like, the cliffhangers that happen not just at the end of every book, but throughout the books. Like, between each segment where there's, like, a group of three chapters, there at the end of each chapter, there's kind of a cliffhanger. And between those sections, there's a cliffhanger. And in a weird cross-media comparison, like, when I watched all of Marmalade Boy, I would watch an episode from one commercial break to the commercial break of the next episode, because the cliffhanger in the middle was too much. Right. So I'm like, I can't walk away from the show if I'm stopping. It's the same kind of thing with Gwyn Saga, where I'm not going to stop at the end of book four and then later pick up. No, I'm going to, like, read a chapter into book five before putting it down.
And it's, you know, like I said before, the form factor is part of how they keep you going. If it was all one book...
Yeah, I would be really intimidated. Well.
Yeah, there was a big discussion at Vertical, like, when we were going to put out the hardcover. Are we going to try to do, let's say, the five books in two volumes in English? Because, you know, American fantasy books tend to be so thick. But we just decided to do, you know, this format, I think, which was a good idea.
I mean, further down the line, I could see a digest version. Like what Viz is doing now with some of their titles. They've got the Viz Big Edition, where they'll have a 1995 price point. It's a slightly larger, I think it's a hardcover.
Yeah.
And it's basically the first three volumes. Mm. Three volumes at a time. And they're doing this, thank God, they're doing this with Vagabond.
I will spend
my
Vagabond
own money on that. That's one of my favorite series currently running, for many of the same reasons. And... so I could sort of see the same thing here, but then I thought about it, and I said, you know, part of the fun is the fact that you get to the end, and that's it. You got to wait for the next one to come out. That's part and parcel of how it all works. It's not a defect.
Also, for someone like me, I don't read a lot of very long books. When I started reviewing manga, I started reading all these, you know, very short, quick works. And after a while, it's like, then I get a light novel in the mail. I'm like, oh my God, so much text.
Even that, you know, just last week, I picked up when I was in Portland for a convention. I picked up a copy of Crime and Punishment. It's a newer translation. I'd read a much older, like, really fusty translation in college, and it put me to sleep. And I opened this one up, and I swear to God, I got through almost half of the book while on the plane back home.
You know, The Brothers Karamazov is a bestseller in Japan now with a new translation.
I'm not surprised either.
But wait, my question is for that.
That's a very Japanese text.
I know in Japan, like, the Harry Potter books are divided up into, like, little volumes. So instead of one giant book, you can have, like, two or three volumes at a time.
Because,
like, that's very portable, and it's great. For me, like, reading extremely lengthy volumes is intimidating, and it's not portable. So then the shorter format of Gwyn Saga
feels one of the other
torn.
Books I'm sort of hoping will get picked up. Futari Yamada's Makai Tenshin.
Yeah.
I would love to see more of his stuff. And they just came out with the novel that he wrote that was adapted into Basilisk.
Del Rey.
Del Rey brought that out. I loved it. And this has been made into a movie a bunch of times. The first one is Sonny Chiba in 1981, and it's just great fun. Basically, you've got this Christian martyr who makes a deal with the devil. He resurrects all these dead samurai, and only the ninja Yagyu Jubei can stop him. It's great fun. And again, you know, this would normally be in one volume in the U.S., and here it's in two smaller paperback ones.
Yeah, so you can carry it more easily.
And again, there's that
which is not really an issue in America.
Cliffhanger, bang, right in the middle. You know.
Oh, in the middle of the two volumes.
Right.
I like to say that the covers of these look kind of like heavy metal artwork, or possibly tattoos.
I really wish there would be more English language anthologies of cover art for this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, because I would instantly buy
A guy, the guy who did the Japanese posters for the Star Wars films, Noriyoshi Arai. There has got to be an English language compilation of his stuff some point down the line, because he's just got so many good things. It's very reminiscent of this type of work, too.
It looks like this was him at first.
Have you thought about doing a book like that?
Oh, we would like to. Well, you know, Amano, who starts doing the covers for the Gwen Saga series, beginning with volume 20-something, there already are books of, I think, his art.
Oh, yeah.
There's stuff, I actually got to look at a couple of them. Dark Horse was kind enough to send them over, and I wrote rave reviews. And with any luck, I might even be able to get some sit-down time with either him or Kevin Leahy or the author of the D books. I went at NYAF. If I do get some sit-down time with Amano, first thing I'm going to ask him is, so what on earth compelled you to do a live-action movie version of 10 Nights of Dreams? I want to hear him talk about that, because that's coming out on DVD in the U.S.
I see. For the Gwyn Saga, though, he isn't one of my favorite cover artists. You know, he went from, like, I think 25 to 60-something, but and it was that and his art for the Final Fantasy series that, you know, made him famous. But I feel that the Gwyn Saga benefits more from, this is Kato Naoki for the, you know, first 20-odd volumes, a more Franzetta-esque style that makes it clear that one of the main inspirations is 20s pulp fiction.
Yeah.
Amano's work is very
kind of fey.
It's always his style. And I think that's part of the reason why I didn't have as much of a problem. Mm. Because, okay, this is Gwyn via him, by Yoshitaka Amano.
His art suits the material better when the action is taking place in the cities, you know, and you have all these courtiers.
Amano's lines are very clean, style is very Baroque, whereas this is mud and blood and muscles and sweat.
And you really feel the illustrations that are in the books, were they scratchboard?
They look like daguerreotypes or something,
this looks like scratchboard. Yeah.
Or like heavy charcoal.
Right. It does not feel like an actual drawing. It feels like some of the medium work. And I really like that. Like you said, it gives this grit to it.
Mm. Yeah, it gets across the intensity.
What's interesting, too, is that we were talking about prophecies earlier, but all those magi, fortune tellers, they are so powerless in the Gwyn Saga, you know? Like in Tolkien, you have Gandalf, or, you know, you have powerful magicians in other fantasy series. They tend to be powerless in this. Kurimoto made a conscious decision to have magic not that be powerful in the main series. And in the side stories, of which there are maybe a two dozen, magic is potent. And the first volume is called The Seven Magi, and magic is a real force there, but not in the Gwyn Saga proper. So instead, you have, you know, a leader like Gwyn devising plans, you know. That becomes more important when you can't just, you know, do things by magic.
Mm. Yeah.
And that machine is not understood for the longest time. They don't know how to use that transportation machine, which, you know, throws Rinda and Remus into the rootwood.
And, the powerful sorcerer with the skull face with skin burned off.
That whole digression where he talks about how this happened.
Yeah.
He has some kind of powerful magic, but it really doesn't, he doesn't really get to use it.
I think there's two things. One is that in a lot of low fantasy magic, it tends to be depowered by definition, because it tends to distract you from the central premises.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the whole thing is really about the people and what they accomplish with their bare hands, basically. Magic is kind of like a cheat on top of that. And the other thing is that I think it also speaks at least partly, it's like a flip side of the same thing, is that, you know, part of the reason why Gwyn is what he is, why he is a hero, is because he gets right in along with everybody else and bends his back muscles.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he does everything with his own hands.
We recently saw, what was the movie from Thailand? Is it a two-parter that's going to be a three-parter?
King Narasan.
Narasan is a story about a fighting king in like the mid-1500s.
I'm all over that.
You need to see that because it's the most expensive movie ever made in Thailand by the guy ninth in line to the crown.
Yeah, I've heard about this fellow before. So
they showed it at the New York Asian Film Festival here, like the first two parts. There's a third, but it doesn't end. It ends leading into a part three. The first movie is not very well structured, but the second one is all... I think it would appeal to like Gwyn Saga fans because it's a fighting king who's down there fighting.
And anything Thailand plus stuff. Martial arts, I'm all over in 2 seconds. So.
It also has a magical gun and a lot of elephants.
Magical
and no
elephant gun.
And like no special effects.
9 feet long.
You can really tell.
Everything
like,
is practical. It's
you
all
can
on
tell
screen.
It's all extras. It's never never CG for their fights.
It's tough to comment on the on Gwyn Saga sort of like in terms of overarching themes having only been familiarized with the first five books, but there is very clearly this dichotomy between Gwyn and M. Nellis, where M. Nellis is very aristocratic and very...
You said you were like, we haven't seen her fight.
Yeah, by the end of it. Well, I don't... That's a spoiler. That's something.
She's really got a tactical mind, and then you have Gwyn, who's basically putting together things out of nothing.
Well, that's just it.
I love that contrast.
She leads, but she doesn't lead like Gwyn leads. Gwyn is in the trenches.
Right.
And she's a general, and she's very intelligent.
Perfect example of this, when they're going across the Valley of the Yido, and Gwyn says, well, I'm going to go across, too. You know, and everyone at first is sort of shocked by this. They're like, why are you risking your neck? And for him, this is just how it's done. You risk your neck with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, if they can't see him doing it, then they're not going to follow him. Just nodding and grinning the whole time.
He takes the biggest risk, you know. He has to run through the Edo.
It's like these poisonous jellyfish things.
And that's a hero. The hero is the guy who sticks his neck out and inspires everybody else to do the same. But he has to do it first.
Well, and it's truly the case as opposed to like the superhero medium where you have people where their heroism is defined by the sort of extent of their power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, however powerful they are is how heroic they are.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas one of the things, and it's so tough to say because I've read there are five books here out of 120, so who knows
you
what
have
ends
what
up
I have
happening,
to work
right?
Yeah. Don't feel bad.
But it is more a question of you know what are you willing to risk?
Mm.
How great the sacrifice will
and
you make?
Charisma, you know, like
certainly
something else just hit me, which is when we first meet the guy, he's basically an empty shell. He doesn't know who he is or what he is. He just knows that he has this body and this head and that he maybe has some trivia about the way his world works, which comes back to him at the oddest moments.
Mm.
And the whole thing that I see happening across these first five books is him trying to put together an identity for himself, a persona. And a lot of that is in how other people see him. These two kids, they see him the first time, they're scared to death. And then they realize, this man is in as much trouble as we are. He needs our help. And he looks at them and something clicks. He's like... I need to be there for them because they're helpless, just as I'm helpless. And from that, something begins to build, and then his whole identity starts to come out of that too.
Mm.
And what a wonderful character to be able to sort of put yourself into.
Yes,
right.
isn't that what everybody wants?
And
is
empathy.
To wake up with no history,
exactly.
With an enormously powerful body and dangers to face.
That's part of all fantasy.
With Tezuka's manga Dororo, we had the tagline "Nobody's born whole," because the protagonist is born without body parts, they're. Again, the protagonist is an allegory of... his case is extreme, but everyone's situation is similar in a way. And that's what we try to say by, nobody's born whole. And for the Gwyn Saga, in that sense, we could say, like, nobody's born maskless. You know, you start with not knowing who you are, and you have to go through the world.
And again, to have this stuff in the context of this rip-roaring fantasy is just wonderful, because neither side has been compromised. They're both engaging each other. Usually when you have something with a lot of adventure in it, the psychology, if there is any, is just, pitched out the window. But here, one drives the other, and vice versa.
Mm.
And I don't see that enough. I see that very, very rarely. I love the Vampire Hunter D books, but they are not about psychology. They are basically about attitude.
Gestures.
Right, gestures. It's more like a kabuki performance. Mm. You don't really read the thing to learn about D as a character, although there are hints of that along the way. You watch what he does next. That's what makes him interesting. Not nearly as interesting as Gwyn, although still interesting in his own way. And I love the fact that the world that they put him in has so many, again, so many facets to it. So they have all this fun revealing all the different parts of his world as he walks through it. But I know that for my money, I go to Gwyn to get much more of a real sense of empathy for the character. I want to know where he goes.
With a character like Dee or a character like Golgo, where the character, part of the character is the mask.
Right.
I mean, part of Gwyn is the mask, but the difference is that Gwyn, at a number of different stages, is unsure of himself. He sometimes is without a plan.
And this is all given right to us.
Find him in terrible danger. So there is not the sense of this sort of impenetrable caricature like a James Bond, who always knows what to do. He might be powerful, but at the same time, he's vulnerable.
Yeah. Very funny that you mentioned Golgo, because Viz sent me the last volume of the anthologies that they've been putting together. They didn't license the whole thing. That would have been suicide.
Oh, yeah, I heard but, it was just Carl Horn.
But they put together,
books.
I mean, it's hard to do worse than Carl Horn.
It is.
And,
Carl Horn.
No, I mean, hard to do better. What am I saying? And they picked some really good ones. And I kept saying to myself, you know, one of the really striking things about this series is that 90% of the time, the protagonist isn't even there. And then I realized it's not about a protagonist. It's about the influence that he has in the environment, even when he's not in the room. It's really about it's about his ghost hanging over everything. And that's a very difficult thing for some people to wrap their minds around, because they want the guy to be there front and center. And sometimes this can fall flat on its face, like the blood novel Night of the Beasts, where they tried to do the same thing and they failed miserably. Complete failure.
That sort of happens in the Gwyn saga too. From 50 to 70, Gwyn is almost not there. You know, he has to go on adventures, which many of which are told in the side stories. Okay. So you learn about them before, you know, we get to that point in history.
But just like you said,
you know, his absence, but everyone, you know, is moving, doing this or that because Gwyn might do this or that. You know, he's always a force.
WWGD.
By the fifth book, I had, like, there's an interesting sort of comparison we made with recent episodes of Doctor Who, where there was, like, a disappointing season finale part where Earth is being attacked by aliens and the Doctor's not around, and they're like, what do we do? And their emergency plan seems only to be, like, we'll just call the Doctor and really call... Anyway, it doesn't go well. But in the Gwyn saga, I mean, in the end of this arc, it seems like Gwyn isn't showing back up and they're really in a lot of trouble, but there's never that kind of moment like, that was our only plan. But they're sort of like, it's more like, well, that's our last hope if he shows up, and if not, well...
And you know that there's going to be a big climactic battle at the end. But even then, the execution of it is so fantastic that, you know...
Right. I was really left hanging till the end.
I love how she's constantly pulling these totally off-the-table ideas out of nowhere. I mean, the whole thing with the Valley of the Edo. Any of us who played D&D know about the gelatinous cube.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's been like a couple hours and we have a train
full of them. Yeah. How's that for lunch?
So, I was going to ask if there are, like, RPG... books, what, like, expansion, what do you call them?
Modules?
Yeah.
Not that I know of. No, I'm a big fan of tabletop RPGs, too, so...
There are several record albums that have... They're on Amazon. I'm actually... And they're not that expensive.
She composes, too, Kurimoto-san.
Oh, my God.
She's composed a full musical based on the Gwyn saga. And it's been put on in Tokyo, you know?
Okay, now I'm going to have to get those out.
And another fascinating thing about the Gwyn saga, we all know that this started in 1979, but we started publishing it in 2003 in June, and that's right when America was going into Iraq. In a weird sense, you know, like if this series were written in 2000, you know, actually came out then, people would be saying, hey, this must be some kind of commentary on the Iraq War.
And I think that's a huge mistake, because whenever people look at a particular... I mean, people are doing this right now with The Dark Knight, which I think is a really stupid idea. They take it and they look at what's going on and they try to force fit it into some political mold, you know, trying to draw some equations that part of the problem is that, one, this is totally arbitrary. Anybody can come up with a formula like that for anything based on current events. And the other part of it is that, in a lot of ways, I think it really distracts you from being able to savor the thing for what it is. When you're looking at everything as a political commentary, everything as some kind of equivocation, oh, this really means this.
But I mean, that's the function of narrative, is to help you interpret the current...
Well, yeah, but this, right, yeah. this seems a really kind of ham-handed way to do it. It's just, it cuts off more opportunities and opens them up.
Mm. But at least it opens up a kind of dialogue using narrative to explain more complicated situations,
it's just
even if it's not.
I think the real action is elsewhere.
That. Yeah. Mm.
But. So I like the fact that this came out after the Iraq War, but it was actually written before it, so people won't see it as
if it's good, you know, it's always going to be good.
Right. There's going to be something like that, you know?
It's always going to be timeless, too. Right? Now, I was reading it. One thing I was thinking when I was reading this is saying, you know, I can see us picking this up in another 100 years without blinking and just ripping right through it the same way. You know, it does not feel like something that was a product of any particular moment in time.
Yes.
And, that's a great thing. Yeah. That's really hard to do. Even when I read, you know, because even when I read modern fantasy in general, I always get the feeling that it was not produced in the same kind of, you know, outside of time. It feels like somebody producing it today, here and now, and just sort of bending themselves in this weird position and not use certain words.
Oh. You know? Tolkien comes right out of World War II.
Sure.
And it's unquestionably there. It's there the whole time. He's denied it, but you can feel it. You feel...
And, of course, the Tolkien thing... with Tolkien, of course, it's a battle between good and evil, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas with Kurimoto, you don't have anyone that's evil. The real evil is the monsters in the River Kess. But the main players, the Mongol, you know, they're not evil. They're just misguided, imperialistic.
They're a nation with their own interests.
Yeah. And, of course, Paros has its own problems, too, you know? Yeah. They're not the good guys. And Gwyn, sometimes he goes into berserk mode, and when he first comes out, of course, he seems like a horror, you know, monster, right? He seems like the evil guy. And Sam, you know, we start to feel close to them, but, you know, when they first show up,
they slaughter a bunch of humans, and you're like, wow, they're most sympathetic.
That's, again, another thing is there's a very nice sense of how things are morally in flux, that we are not necessarily going to see the same divisions. We are going to continue, when we see a friendship, you know, forged in the series, and this definitely happens in book 3 and 4, there's no guarantee that friendship will continue, or on what terms.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of courage to put together something of this dimension with those types of, without those kinds of safeties. I mean, one of the things that, like, for instance, you fall back to D again for a moment, you know, there's certain things that are consistent from book to book all the time. And every now and then he'll find a way to tweak that a bit, but again, there is this strong sense that when you pick up the book, you know pretty much what you're going to get. And again, in the same way, and in a very reduced way, you know kind of what you're going to get here, but you're going to get more surprises than comfort.
And what's amazing is that, and this is a sign of just how massive the story is, even though the basic theme is no one's totally good, no one's totally evil, we do get the Sauron-like evil character, too.
Yeah.
We even have that, you know.
It's not totally ignorable. It's just that you know that it's going to get brought in a way that complements everything else that's been going on. He's not just going to be trotted out as a disposable enemy. There's going to be some complexity there.
And like in the first side story, which the manga is based on, you do get that kind of absolute evil type of character.
I was going to say, like, at least in these first 5 books, the moral ambiguity of the villains is more like in Miyazaki films or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like how the
That's
villains
a beautiful comparison. One of the things that I love about the Miyazaki movies is that exact thing, is that when you see somebody, you see them in their whole.
Yeah.
Mm. You like Lady Eboshi from Mononoke. She's not a bad person at all.
No,
She's just trying to direct her energies in a way that is going to be very counterproductive.
Yeah. But she has her goals and that she's trying to achieve.
They just
and she's
happen
not
to conflict
a bad person.
With a lot of other people.
It's just yeah.
And that really takes somebody in the driver's seat with compassion. That takes a lot of work to have that kind of perspective. It's very easy just to cast somebody as a bad guy and be done with it.
Mm.
it takes a lot more work to be able to say, okay, well, what is it that they're doing that I see as bad?
Mm.
What is it that they're doing that somebody else reading this is going to see as bad? How can we dig under that and see what's really going on?
Well, that's
hard.
And
that's
also to make that ambivalence, you know, something that's fun rather than your teacher telling you you shouldn't see things in absolutes. You know, Final Fantasy also does a great job of, you know, mobilizing ambivalence for the terms of just sheer fun, you know, narrative rather than something ethical that you should abide by. You can make a story more fun by making things ambivalent, you know, people turning from good to evil.
And again, it's because there is this emotional weight that goes with everything that's going on. They know how to build that. They don't know how to sustain that.
Mm.
And there's so much of the popular culture in Japan is centers around doing that. So again, it's a big part of the reason why I dig it so much is because they're giving me something I'm not getting anywhere else.
Yeah. I guess so much of Western literature or films is kind of, a lot of times you get a sense that they're building towards a theme or some kind of moral or lesson, but by the end of book five, I was sort of like, there's a lot of turnabout slaughtering of people, and I'm like, what am I supposed to walk away with here that might makes right, but not really, because either side was winning at either time. And it's,
I think in the West, literary fiction is supposed to, like, not deal with such absolutes, and that's why it's better regarded, whereas genre fiction does the absolutes. I think that there's been such a divide, whereas in Japan, even with genre fiction, you don't have those absolutes. That's what's interesting about it.
Well, back to Crime and Punishment. Again, I mean, when I was reading that, and again, in this new translation, I'm finally saying, okay, now I understand why so many people have responded emotionally to Raskolnikov as a character, because he's... There was a phrase I heard once. I can't remember who said it, but basically, evil is nothing but good tortured by its own hunger and thirst. He would not be a bad person if not for the fact that he is compelled to try and prove his superiorness.
It makes me think of the Brechtian quote, even saints can act as sinners when they haven't had their dinners. Through Penny Opera.
Right. And as I was reading it, I kept thinking back again to all of this, you know, Japanese pop culture that I'd been immersing myself in, and saying, you know, there, we talk about the differences between high and low culture, you know, popular culture and you know, the more refined culture. And really, I don't think the difference is a question of high versus low, you know, or refinement versus lack of refinement.
Mm-hmm.
It's more a question of what are you really trying to draw out of your readers? Are you just trying to involve them in a mechanical process, or are you trying to connect with them emotionally? And if you're trying to connect with them emotionally, are you doing that on valid terms or not? Because I know so many stories, when I do a roundtable about storytelling, one of the terms I use is stacking the deck, which can be done well or badly, meaning that you front load things emotionally in a certain way to make us feel a certain way about a character.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that incompetently, or if you do that on bad faith, what you're basically doing is wringing tears out of the audience or inspiring contempt when there's none clearly deserved. There's nothing worse than a story where the author clearly doesn't know as much about the characters as the reader does. So you have to be careful with it, but when you can pull it off, it's beautiful.
Talking like Allison.
I don't know how much audio we're down for, but this is now about an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
We have here.
Well, I think we have enough material, maybe.
Do you want to do a little outro? Do you want to wrap it up?
I don't have anything prepared.
Final thoughts or anything
buy the books.
Get to?
Yeah, buy the books. Even if there's no movie, if people buy the books, we'll do more books.
They're darn well
done. I'm just asking for 3,000 of you.
Yeah.
Preferably 5,000.
And if you've now listened to the entire roundtable discussion, that should be enough to at least make you feel as though it's worth a try, a chance. Yeah. Give it a shot.
Book, you'll be hooked.
You know?
Trust me.
I described these to Rose, and she was like, you know, I just like fantasy series that go on, like, forever. And I'm like, do I have the series for you? I told her about the plot, and she was like, I need to read this immediately.
Oh, that's one.
Everyone that I've told about it who has had spare cash has snapped it up. And the ones who didn't have spare cash, I sent them my hardcover copies. I had no qualms at all about parting with them when I knew they'd find a good home.
When I first discovered it, there were, I think, maybe about 20 or so volumes. It was summer vacation, and I read like 3 or 4 per day. I did nothing else for like a week.
You remember those days? It's not like that anymore. Right.
Those days are back, trust me. Those days are back.
Oh, because now you got to work. There is no summer vacation.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought there was that study that was like you can read faster in Japanese because the kanji is fast read, so Japanese people can read much faster.
I don't know.
But you read
that.
Both. So,
I don't know, it's about the same. I'd say
probably comes out about the same because of the differences between the two. I read Japanese very, very badly and very slowly, but I can translate it with a certain amount of effort. Like, for fun, at one point I sat down with Sosuke's Bochan, and I started translating the first couple of paragraphs of that. And then I found out that a newer translation had been commissioned just a couple of years ago, and I said, okay, well, I guess that ends that experiment. Because it was what I read of it was really, really good. It was much better than any of the previous ones I'd seen.
I guess, I have two quick questions for the ending of it. So in a lot of fighting games, and I forget, there's often
the Tekken
like...
games.
Yeah,
we
like
have
the Tekken
the,
games,
yeah, the character
there's a
King
character with
very
that.
Clearly a Guin tribute.
Okay, that's where that's from.
I am almost positive it's a direct tribute. Well,
you don't think so?
If anything, and I am not, I know very little about Japanese wrestling. But I know that there was a Jaguar...
Tiger Mask.
Yeah. Wrestler that I believe predates... I don't know if it predates Gwyn, but I don't know if it's Gwyn-inspired.
Well, I think it predates Gwyn. Mm. But the Masked Warrior, you know, I mean, that's
the
an archetype already.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a pretty, pretty old archetype.
Certainly.
Yeah.
It's just so primal, you know. Mm. What's the first thing that we do when we look at somebody? Again, that's why anime characters have such big eyes, because that's where the emotional connection is made, through the eyes. And then you try to make that connection with somebody, and you don't get it, and then that's where the dread starts.
So it's kind of, it's a little unclear in the earlier in the books, but I mean, is it a mask, or is it a leopard head?
Deliberately. Yes, that's ambiguous.
Because sometimes he's like reaching into his mouth, and it seems like there's another mouth within, and other times it seems like
the way that I was reading that, I was saying to myself, that sounds also like you could read it as someone who does not quite recognize how the structure of his face has changed.
Yeah.
Because a cat's mouth is built entirely differently from a human mouth.
Yeah.
The best way to think about it is that it's a result of sorcery. So don't think of it physically, like how does he put that piece of meat? You know, it's like a sorcerer's transformation.
It's just there.
It's
to do
one
and that was actually one of the things I was talking about with my friend. He's like, you know, if they do make the movie, do they do a mask or do they do CGI or what? And then he showed me the CGI clip that was like from like the last couple of weeks of this incredibly expressive human face. I couldn't believe it was CGI. And I said, okay, I guess it's CGI. You know, with a couple of stunt heads as needed. But, you know, the fact that they can do this stuff now at all.
Yeah.
I mean, 20 years ago, if they tried doing this stuff 20 years ago, for instance, it would have been a mask. It would look terrible.
Yeah.
My Harryhausen version?
No. Not even that. I'm talking more like,
like 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. When basically a practical effect was really all you could do for something like that. The seams would have been immediately obvious. But if you could... The only way to really deal with that would be to have fun with it, you know, make it deliberately cheesy. But that was not something you can do with this material. You have to be faithful.
Are we good then?
Wow. I think we are.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.